This is a download from the BBC. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radiowales.
Hello, I'm Roy Jenkins. Welcome to All Things Considered. Graffiti painted on a pristine wall is usually bemoaned as an act of vandalism, and it prompts predictable indignation. But today we visit a church where graffiti has not only been tolerated, it's been commissioned as part of its attempt to get its community thinking about the Easter story. More of that shortly. But first, a pilgrimage to St David's this month, which will strengthen links between Wales and Armenia, the former Soviet Republic in the Caucasus, which was the first country in the world to recognise Christianity as its official religion. Pilgrims will be travelling from across England and Wales for what's believed to be the first ever celebration of the Armenian liturgy in an Anglican cathedral. Led by the Armenian Apostolic Orthodox Church Primate in Great Britain and Ireland, they will also commemorate those who died in what they regard as the genocide of the First World War. I'm joined by John Tarossian of the Armenian community in Cardiff, who've promoted the pilgrimage, and from our studio in Carmarthen by one of the people who'll be welcoming them to St David's, Canon Patrick Thomas. He's made 4 trips to the Republic and has a book on Armenia and Wales being published later this year. John, the Armenian church in Wales, most of it's in Cardiff and around Cardiff, but it's very small, isn't it? How strong, how active is it? And, I mean, how does it go about its life?
Well, it is very small. There's 35 to 55 people within the Armenian community in South Wales. But it is very active because it is at the forefront of the push for recognition of the genocide. And that is in part due to the acceptance by the Welsh Assembly and most of the major churches in Wales of the Armenian genocides. So the community is held together partly for religious reasons, and we come together once a month for Mass, and also we come together for memorials at the genocide, memorial at the temple.
To the Temple of Peace.
At the Temple of Peace. Mm-hmm. We also have other dates within the year that we celebrate. So we have around 6 to 8 meetings a year.
And your services of worship, and I suspect this will astonish many people, are actually held in a Baptist church. Why is that?
Baptist church only because of the name of Ararat. No other reason. Of course, the significance of Ararat is the mountain, which was the Armenian symbol, which was in old Armenia, now in Turkey, but visible from all around Armenia and especially the capital city. It dominates it.
How difficult to keep a sense of your religious tradition, the religious identity, when the community is so small?
Both the religious and ethnic identities are very difficult. We do assimilate very well within other cultures. So what's happened is there's a huge amount of mixed marriages and assimilation. But that's okay. As long as we can keep some form of our culture, we're happy.
So why do you want to keep the religious services going?
Well, everything in Turkey or old Armenia or whatever you want to call it was focused around the church. You had the church first, and then annexed to it was the school. Annexed to that was a hospital. And the whole community revolved around the church. So the church is vital.
So what is the most significant thing about this pilgrimage that you're planning?
The significance of this pilgrimage is there's a few firsts, apart from the fact that it's the first service to be held in an Anglican cathedral. It's also the 10th anniversary of the recognition of the Armenian genocide by the Welsh Assembly and by the church in Wales, the nonconformist churches, Roman Catholic, by all the major churches in Wales. Also, it's very close to our 24th April Genocide Remembrance Day, and 24th of April this year happens to be Easter. So there's a multiple commemorations going to take place.
Multiple indeed. Now, Patrick Thomas, recognition of the genocide is a highly controversial area. Why is that? Why is it so controversial?
Well, I think it's something that only became controversial in the last few years. I mean, what happened originally was that after the genocide took place, after over a million Armenians were killed in Turkey during the First World War, there were trials of some of the people who were responsible. But many of them had fled to Germany, But at that time, it was still recognised that something very appalling had happened in Turkey during the First World War. However, then there was a rise of Turkish nationalism, Turkey re-established itself, and everybody in the international community wanted to be friends with Turkey, so they didn't want to emphasise something rather embarrassing. And indeed, Hitler, just before he invaded Poland, said, "Who now remembers the annihilation of the Armenians?" The whole thing had been swept under the carpet. And of course, once you sweep a genocide under the carpet, there's the danger that other genocides will happen, as indeed occurred. So it is something that has become important. Turkish nationalists obviously reject the fact. They try and say, well, it wasn't something that was organised.
They would say it wasn't genocide, wouldn't they? They would not dispute that there were very large numbers of people killed. I mean, I read figures between 600,000 and 1.5 million. But, I mean, what they would say, well, this was part of a war going on, and it was not a deliberate attempt to wipe out a whole people in the sense that Hitler was doing to the Jews.
Yes, unfortunately, that's not actually true. What happened was that certainly there were places where there were Armenians near the front, where there was the possibility of seeing the Armenians as a danger. But they also wiped out whole communities of Armenians. The men had been conscripted for the Turkish army. They were disarmed and taken away and shot, normally after having dug their own graves. And the women and children were sent on death marches, which ended up in the Syrian desert, and many of them were killed along the way. So it was something that was systematic.
John, it's obviously very important to you that you have this memorial at the Temple of Peace in Cardiff, and that the Welsh Assembly government has acknowledged that there was genocide and so on. But how do you respond to those who say, well, having such a memorial and having regular commemorations is actually quite divisive, that we should be moving on, looking to the future, and that it's actually keeping old bitternesses alive?
Well, actually, I think it's absolutely the contrary to that. What's happening is that because UK in general does not recognise the Armenian genocide, and Turkey, Israel, United States, so on, what there's a frustration that this matter has not been put to bed. It's not just myself, I speak for perhaps 90% of the Armenians, that until there is an official recognition, we can't move on. And this is a problem.
Patrick, tell me, Wales and Armenia. Ask most people, I suspect they would say, not much connection there.
I think there has been a connection for a very long time, actually. There are certain parallels between Welsh culture and Armenian culture, and you see it particularly in the fact that both of us are ancient Christian countries, obviously Armenia being the most ancient Christian country, on the fringes of Christendom. And there are certain parallel developments. And the Armenians have their khachkars, which are these incredibly beautiful carved stone crosses that combine the symbolism of the cross and the tree of life. And we have our Celtic crosses. And there are certain parallels between the two. There are even words in Armenian that are actually almost exactly the same as words in Welsh, because they're both Indo-European languages. But also there's been a close connection, particularly since the 1890s, when there were terrible massacres of Armenians in Turkey, which were a sort of prelude to the genocide. And at that point, Mr. Gladstone made a speech in which he said, to serve the Armenians is to serve civilization. Because Gladstone had supported the Armenians in their time of need, the Armenians of Manchester were so grateful to Gladstone that when Gladstone died, they paid for his tomb in Harden Church, and they also paid for a memorial window to him there, and they presented the library, St. Daniel's Library, now the Gladstone Library, which was established in his memory, with a medieval Armenian gospel book, a beautifully illuminated gospel book, which is probably its greatest treasure.
So tell me, how did your interest in Armenia begin? And I mean, why so fascinated by this country and its history?
Well, it was purely by chance. I was going through a rather sort of gloomy period, and my wife noticed a small ad in the Church Times saying that her old vicar was leading a pilgrimage to Armenia. So she signed me up for it, and I went. And I was, I mean, merely the fact of looking out of the hotel window in Yerevan when I woke up on the first morning and seeing Mount Ararat was in itself an astonishing experience. But also coming into contact with this fascinating culture where East and West are combined, where there have been so many different influences, and also the sheer resilience of the Armenian people who've been through so much and yet still have wonderful moments of joy and exultation, and also the richness of discovering a strand of Christianity of which I knew nothing.
Any sense, Patrick, in which your travels to Armenia, all your reading about it, all your encounters with Armenian people, have changed your understanding of faith?
I think one of the things that has always been a problem for me, as for many Christians, is how you reconcile a loving God and the suffering of Christians. And certainly, and the place of the cross, and particularly the cross as the tree of life, the cross as a symbol of also of resurrection within the Armenian tradition, and the way that's been lived through, that people who have undergone the most appalling suffering have still managed through that. Admittedly, many of them have been through, you know, deep times of darkness as well, but have managed to maintain their faith, is something that I find profoundly moving and also profoundly helpful as well.
The service at St. David's Cathedral, last Saturday this month, April the 30th. I mean, there are these pilgrims coming who are Armenian people from various places. Can anybody come, John?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we have quite a few Welsh, English friends who will be attending.
And what are they likely to experience, Patrick Thomas? You know, tasting Armenian liturgy, maybe the first time.
Well, one of the things that is most striking is the beauty of the chants. As perhaps with most Eastern Christian liturgies, it's a sort of slice of heaven that comes down to earth and then lifts you up to heaven again. So there is extraordinarily beautiful music, which in itself creates an atmosphere that certainly I find profoundly moving whenever I've been at an Armenian liturgy.
So a taste of heaven in store. Patrick Thomas, John Tarossian, many thanks. If you've just joined us, you're listening to All Things Considered here on BBC Radio Wales. Graffiti is usually regarded as one of the plagues of the urban street scene. It can be a nightmare for those responsible for keeping their buildings looking trim. So it's been something of a surprise to find a church which has actually chosen to put graffiti on one of its walls. We're in Rubina, once a village 3 miles from the centre of Cardiff, but now swallowed up as a city suburb. Beulah United Reformed Church stands at a busy crossroads among the shops, estate agents and eating establishments. And facing it across the road, in the original chapel building, is the Canolvan, the church centre. And it's here that the graffiti greets passers-by. Jesus graffiti, to be precise. Peter Crushley-Jones is the minister of Beulah.
Peter!
Hello!
Hello, Joe!
Hello!
Oh, well, that's a very imaginative picture, I must say. Yes, yeah. You're painting over what was there before?
Yes.
Yeah, right, OK.
They only appear one at a time.
Yes.
Roy, one or two people have said, let's keep them here all the time, but they're only meant to be here for a fleeting moment, and then they get replaced.
Right.
So the current one is around the corner.
Ah,
which
right.
Is the one of Jesus and the child.
Ah, yeah, so Jesus in jeans, of course. It's Jesus and the child. How is anybody going to know it's Jesus?
Well, I think our theory, Roy, was that if people see a skinny, barefoot man with a beard, they think it's Jesus. So our first image was of a very typical Christ-like image with his arms open wide, and that established that when this character appeared again, it would continue to be Jesus in different forms. And so, you know, it's an odd thing that people still persist in seeing and sensing, if they see this figure, that it's meant to portray Jesus himself.
Yeah. And what's the point of the child being thrown into the air?
Well, I think we wanted to capture this spirit of play. We have, obviously, the biblical story of Jesus' concern for children and his image of blessing. And all of these images are subverting typical religious attitudes, and we would have imagined an act of blessing would be a rather serious-faced moment, and his thumb might be making the sign of the cross on the child's head or something like that. But we wanted instead to convey that when Jesus met these children, particularly because his disciples were so cross with them and him about it, that he would simply rejoice and be at play with them all. So we captured it in this way.
A little noisy out here. I think we'll go inside to find out what it's all about. Peter, most churches don't welcome graffiti on the outside of their premises, let alone put it there. Why?
Well, we decided to do this because we had set out with a plan to try and tell the life of Jesus in visual form. At Christmas, in the Victorian evening that happens in Rabai, it was quite easy to create a series of installations and things that would tell the life story of Jesus' birth, because people were looking for somewhere to come into on a wet December evening. But we realised after that, wanting to tell the life story of Jesus, we would need to put it somewhere else where people might come. And then we thought, well, the whole idea of this is to put Jesus out of the frame, so let's take him out of the church and put him on the wall. And so we thought, well, graffiti would be a new way to visualise Jesus' particular stories. And we thought, well, we'll put it on our own wall. So we have.
But why graffiti? I mean, it's often regarded as a subversive art form.
I think that's one of the reasons why we wanted it to be in graffiti. I think we also feel it's street art, and this idea of following Jesus onto the streets is something that Jesus invited his followers to do, and it gives a freshness that people have appreciated as they've gone through the street.
Now, Joe Jones, you're the person who's actually done the work. You're artist in residence here at Beulah. That sounds very grand. What does it mean in practical terms?
Well, I've been working with the church for about 2.5 years, and Peter's very keen on working with the community and arts, one way of doing it. So I did a project for Life in Fourness, which was the theme a couple of years ago, and did a series of panels. And the idea was to work with as many different people as possible, and art is a medium that allows you to do that. And I'm local to Robina, and my name was given to the church, and I've been working with Peter and the community around the church ever since.
How hard to match up his ideas to the budget available?
Well, it's trying to curb the ideas, because Peter would have me painting the whole church and the whole of Robina if he could. So I have to rein in the ideas. But the logistics of it are quite difficult, because we get the images created for us and we okay them, and then they're printed up, and then I cut the stencil and paint them on the wall. So it's still quite a process.
So let me be clear. You don't actually paint anything yourself. Someone else has actually constructed the frames, and then you spray over. Is that what it comes to? I mean, this is being very, very simplistic, I know.
We've got a graphic design company, an artist called Blethyn, uses a computer, which is a skill that I haven't got, and he creates this image and he brings different pictures together and changes them. They get printed up onto a large sheet of paper, and from that I cut the stencils, which, depending on which stencil, takes between 5 and 7 hours. The stencil's placed on the wall, and then I paint through the image. I don't spray paint it, because we wanted to be able to paint it out afterwards, and it's easier to paint over emulsion paint than a spray can.
Now, Peter's a Christian minister. There's no doubt where he's coming from. Where are you coming from on all this? I mean, any religious motivation for you in this?
No. I've worked a lot with the church, so I feel like part of the family, and I understand the ideas and where they're coming from, and it's quite nice to have a different perspective, so that my understanding, I'm learning all the time about these ideas, but it's also quite nice to have a different perspective from Peter's point of view, someone from the outside looking in and helping create these images.
And what gives you most pleasure in the whole thing? What gives you most satisfaction about it?
I love hearing people's response when I'm painting it on the walls. And I was just out there just now, and someone stopped me and said, "Who painted these?" And I said, Well, I did, but I was painting one out. And people are very concerned that I've been asked to paint them out. They get quite protective over these images. They don't want them to disappear. So they get quite worried that I've been brought in to get rid of the images if they don't see me painting them up. And I get stopped by lots of people to come and ask questions. And they all want them to stay. They don't like the fact that they have to be painted out. But that's the idea, that they are a series. And as one arrives, the last one goes.
John Rees, you're a member of the church here. You've been here a long time. What did you think when you first heard about this idea?
I was excited by it because I think we're doing something for two audiences in using this graffiti. People who come to church have usually got a fairly developed and fixed idea in their minds about Jesus. And it does us all good to have those ideas shaken up a little with images that perhaps we wouldn't have thought of ourselves. It was good for us, but it's also good for us in that we are putting the images outside the church, which is where we really are supposed to be as followers or disciples of Jesus.
I mean, this all sounds very, very mellow and accepting, but surely there must have been some people who were a bit worried about you daubing your very, very nicely painted premises.
I think people were probably surprised at first when they heard about the plan, but I've not heard any adverse reaction from insiders, if you like, the people who belong to the church. They've all responded very favourably indeed to it, which is what we need. We need it to be the whole body of the church reaching out to people outside, because it's not only we who have our fixed ideas. People who don't belong to churches have their fixed ideas, what we are all about and what Jesus is and what he stands for. So we have a two-pronged approach, I feel, in using these graffiti on our outer walls.
So there's one image already there, but that's going to go once a new one arrives, and you're about to start work on it, Joe.
Yes, we stick the stencil onto the wall, and then I start sponging through. So we're going to start doing that any minute now.
Right, well, let's go. So what is this one then?
So this one is Jesus as a beggar, but the beggar carries a placard or a sign which says, "Forget your money, I want change." And we wanted to put Jesus's sort of radical challenge to us and to our way of living into the voice of the poor, which is really the voice of Jesus.
Forget your money,
I want change.
I want change, right. Not a million miles from quite a famous one by Banksy.
Yes, that's right.
The graffiti man.
That's right. Modelled on that sort of idea.
Yeah.
And we wanted, though, to, let's say, to place it into the mouth of Jesus as a description of his attitude and also an indication of so often where his invitation to change comes. You know, it comes from those who live with difficulty and injustice and want to change them.
How did you decide on the images? I mean, there was a great deal of discussion about this beforehand.
We did. We spent time in the small group with John and Joe and others and settled on a number of ideas, of stories, of things we wanted to depict. But yes, we thought we wanted things that picked up some of the key stories or things that, or images that people might not be familiar with.
So you've had Jesus with the children. This is Jesus as beggar.
Yep.
What else has happened and what else is to come?
Well, the first image was Jesus with his arms out, the sort of Christ the Redeemer figure, as it were. And this was the first image that we used. Then we followed it with Jesus coming home from a party with a companion, the woman he'd come home with, as it were, that was to suggest perhaps either the story of the woman at the house of Simon the Pharisee, or the wedding at Cana, but again just to suggest this charismatic figure who people were drawn to and he seemed to welcome and gather into his company.
Hello. Hello. We're doing a programme about this, or at least part of a programme about this. So what do you make of this?
I think it's an experiment and a way of presenting Jesus, a religion, in a different way to which we are accustomed. More to do with the lifestyle that we spend now as opposed to people's picture of it as presented in the Bible.
You've seen the ones that have gone before this?
Yes, I have, yes.
A favourite among those?
Yes, my favourite was the one where he was off with his partner disco dancing. I like that one.
You like the notion of Jesus disco dancing, do you?
Well, you know, why not? That's what kids do today, isn't it? That type of thing. And with a girl on his arm, I think, well, why not? It was great.
This graffiti there, have you seen it before?
No, I haven't.
What do you make of that?
A modern Jesus with a child?
A modern? Right, first time. That's very good.
And why not?
And why not indeed?
It might bring a message home to the youngsters as well, you don't know, mightn't it?
And even some who are just a little bit older as well.
Yes.
It's so clever though, isn't it? I mean, it is so skillful and so clever, isn't it?
We come out of our French class weekly, and as we wander around the corner, this is always, a talking point and something that gives everybody pleasure.
Do you think anybody takes any notice?
Well, I think loads of people will take notice, but there are six of us here now watching, which speaks for itself, doesn't it?
Peter, these are not lasting works of art. Some people have said that's a pity. You know, wouldn't it have been better if they'd been up to date?
It's very tempting, Roy, and I think people would love to see the Redeemer figure come back with his arms open at the crossroads. It's a lovely statement to people, but we also felt that for many of us, our experience of God is fleeting, and it comes and it goes, and we wanted to allow for that and to, again, encourage people to be open to the mystery of God changing, and that this figure of Jesus has many shapes and forms, and we continue to meet him on the street. The challenge is simply to recognise him when he comes.
Peter Gustafson-Jones, many thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And my thanks to all who've welcomed us to Rubina's Graffiti Project. You can see some of the images on our webpage at bbc.co.uk/Radio Wales, which is where you can also hear the programme again or download the free podcast. All Things Considered will be here at the same time next week, but meanwhile, from me, Roy Jenkins, goodbye.